It was a lot of bad news everywhere I was going. You know, I was seeing this sort of devastation. I was seeing little gill nets being placed in mangroves where they were catching fish that were, you know, a couple of inches long or less. I was reading statistics back then and still today of 100 million sharks being killed around the planet, mostly for their fins. You know, the 90% of the big fish in the ocean, I was seeing gill nets that had manta rays and sharks and, you know, billfish, beautiful marlin, you know, dead in nets. It was horrific. And I approached my coverage, you know, more like a conflict photographer.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Novogratz. This is Species Unite. Today's conversation is with underwater photography legend, Brian Skerry. Brian's been a contract photographer for National Geographic magazine since 1998. He is one of the world's most accomplished underwater and marine wildlife photographers. In his four decades of exploring the world's oceans, he's experienced things that very few people have ever experienced, like diving with a population of southern right whales that had never before encountered human beings. He dives 8 months of the year, often in extreme conditions, beneath Arctic ice or in shark-infested waters. And his work brings us the beauty and the majesty of our oceans. But it also brings us the devastation and the destruction that we've caused them. And today is June 8th, which is World Oceans Day. It's the day to celebrate the world's combined efforts to protect the one ocean that we all share. And that ocean is in bad shape. Between oil spills polluting the waters and decimating habitats, overfishing, hunting of marine species, climate change, rising acidity levels, plastic, plastic, and more plastic, things look really bleak for our ocean. But as I learned from Brian, there's still so much we can do. Our ocean is resilient, and there's a lot left to save. It's not too late. I would love to start by talking about kind of the bigger picture and your relationship with the ocean that so few humans have ever had, will ever have, and your relationship with all the inhabitants of the ocean. I'm just curious as what you have to say about this bigger picture of people not connecting with the ocean and with nature in general, and how people get that back.
Right, right. Well, it's really a great question and an important question. You know, I think that humans see the world from a terrestrial-centric viewpoint. And that's understandable, of course, because we are terrestrial creatures. But, you know, when we look at Earth from space, when we saw those photos from NASA for the first time back in the 1960s, and when we look at them today, we very much see that we live on a water planet. You know, it's often been said that about 3/4 of the Earth's surface is ocean, is water, about 72%. And that's true. But I think an even more important statistic, perhaps, is that 98% of the biosphere, 98% of the livable, habitable places on Earth where life can exist are ocean, are water. So we very much live on this water planet, and everything that makes us live on this planet is connected to the ocean. So we get our weather from the ocean, we get a lot of food from it, and we get every other breath that we breathe. Any air-breathing creature here on land gets more than 50% of the oxygen we breathe generated from the ocean. So I think, although we haven't historically looked at things perhaps that way, that we see the world from the land perspective, I do think it's important to sort of remind everybody that we are on an ocean world, and we haven't really treated it very well. We've treated the ocean poorly throughout time, and you know, that's coming back to haunt us.
When you first started, your work was a lot about beauty, and you see so many things no one ever sees. And when it shifted to more of, hey, everyone needs to look at what's happening right here, right now, the devastation that's going on, what was the catalyst for that shift?
I mean, I think it was somewhat of an evolution. You know, there was this trajectory, if you will, in my own personal awareness and just the work I was doing in the ocean. I started scuba diving, you know, exploring the ocean in the late 1970s and then throughout the 80s and 90s, you know, learning photography and trying to become a full-time photojournalist in the ocean. I started working for National Geographic magazine in 1998, so 22 years ago. And in many respects, I suppose like most photographers, I just wanted to make beautiful images of animals or places in which I was interested. But I did begin to see these environmental issues occurring in the ocean, things that maybe weren't apparent to most people. I realized that I had this unique privilege. I was diving on a regular basis. I was seeing things that most folks just never get to see. And I was also reading a lot of scientific papers, you know, in the early 2000s, let's say, that were talking about many of these things. One of those papers, for example, was a scientific white paper that was published in the British journal Nature. And it stated that 90% of the big fish in the ocean have disappeared, that we've taken them all post-World War II because of commercial industrialized overfishing. But this sort of gave validation to what I was seeing. You know, when I was starting to dive in the 70s and 80s, I used to go diving in the waters near my home in New England, and I would see big schools of fish, you know, pollock, and I would see codfish out in Cape Cod Bay on shipwrecks and under rocky ledges and, well, you know, a pretty good abundance of life. And just in my own brief, you know, lifetime there of 10 or 20 years, I was already seeing this reduction of these animals. And the science was sort of backing up what I was seeing. So I realized that as a National Geographic photographer, I had this unique opportunity to reach, you know, maybe 50 million people a month that were reading the magazine around the world. And I wanted to start doing stories about those issues. I felt a sense of responsibility, but I also felt a sense of urgency to do this because, you know, I cared about this stuff. It was very important to me to try to not only highlight the problem, but to look for solutions.
I had a question about the difference from when you started diving in the 70s and now in terms of what you actually see, because now I would imagine you see a lot of plastic.
I do. And that's an analysis that's dead on. That's exactly right. I don't remember in my dives back in the 70s and 80s and even the 90s, I don't remember seeing a lot of plastic. You know, I used to keep a dive logbook. I stopped doing that a long time ago, but I still look back at those logbook entries that I made about many of my dives when I was in my 20s and 30s. And, you know, I think if I was seeing a lot of that stuff, I would have talked about it in my log, but I never did. And I don't have any recollection of it. But today, I almost never go out to sea or make a dive where I don't see plastic. You know, I think it's something like 18 billion pounds of plastic is introduced into the ocean every single year on an annual basis, 18 billion pounds. And I have been to some of the most remote places on the planet. I've been to islands in the Central South Pacific that took me 6 days, 5 or 6 days by boat from Fiji, which is pretty remote, just to get to these places. And these are often, you know, uninhabited islands. And I would swim ashore from the boat and get to what should have been a white, sandy, pristine beach and walking for, you know, half a mile down this beach and you're up to your ankles or calves in plastic trash. It just washes ashore and it's all kinds of plastic. So it's disheartening. It's really, really horrible to see these things. And again, most people won't see that, don't see that. So it's out of sight, out of mind.
What was the first story you did on conservation?
The first story that I did on my own or completely proposed to National Geographic was a story about harp seals, which are Arctic animals. They spend most of their life in the high Arctic, and then for a few weeks each year, they migrate down to a part of Canada known as the Gulf of St. Lawrence or near Newfoundland and Nova Scotia. And historically, during those weeks in February and March, they engage in courtship and mating and pupping if the females had become pregnant the year before. And all of that drama is sort of played out against a backdrop of transient pack ice that moves with wind and tide. Now, historically, that ice would be about 25 feet thick. For as far as the eye could see, the entire Gulf would have been frozen. But as I was working on that story in 2002 and 2003, it was ultimately published as a cover story in 2004, I was realizing, and from in talking to researchers who had worked up there for years, that that ice was declining because of climate change, because of anthropogenic climate change. And it was having a devastating effect on the pups, that they needed a stable platform to nurse from their moms. They only need about 2 weeks. It's the second fastest weaning in the animal kingdom. But if they didn't get that solid platform to nurse, they could fall into the ocean before they're ready and they could die. So I saw some of that mortality occurring back when I was doing that story. But in the years since, the ice has been thinner and thinner most years. And some years there's been no ice at all. And on those years, I was told that the pup mortality rate has increased to 100%. So there was no future age class moving forward for that species. So when we did that story, we published it in 2004, as I mentioned, as a cover story, and it received quite a bit of attention because I focused on the hunting, which was occurring up there, which most people didn't realize was still happening. And that was a serious threat to the animals. But, you know, long term, the bigger threat was clearly going to be this decline of sea ice because of climate change. So, you know, that was really the first one. And then right on the heels of that, when I saw the potential to be able to do more, I proposed a story on the global fisheries crisis, sort of based on my own personal experiences and that scientific paper that I referenced that was published in Nature about the loss of 90% of the big fish in the ocean. So those were sort of the two back-to-back stories, 2004, 2007 cover stories that were really focused on, you know, environmental issues in the ocean.
And with the global fisheries crisis, I mean, has it gotten any better or is it worse than when you did the story?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, I don't think it's really gotten that much better. I guess the good news, if there is any, you know, ray of hope in that equation, is that at the time that I did that story, I also did a separate story in the same issue of the magazine about a solution, and the solution was creating marine protected areas. At the time I was doing that story, only about 1% of the oceans were protected as marine reserves, and most scientists tell us that we need to protect maybe 40% of the ocean. Today, we're at maybe 3%. So there has been some success in terms of creating more marine reserves. In terms of fisheries, you know, again, I think it's a constantly fluid situation, no pun intended, where, you know, some governments are doing a better job of managing certain fisheries, but not overall. There's still factory trawlers out there. There's still, you know, tuna seiners that are, you know, gathering up hundreds of tons of tuna in every time they pull in those nets. So I think we still have a long way to go, but I think there are glimmers of hope. But it is a complex situation.
For people who don't know, will you talk about what overfishing has done and bycatch and what's happening to the oceans, why we've lost 90% of these fish?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the most common methods of fishing in the world, for example, is something called a trawl net, a net that is towed behind a boat. It has two big steel doors on either end. It has usually a float line at the top and a lead-weighted line on the bottom. And that entire assembly is towed behind a fishing boat. And as those big doors on either end of the net meet resistance from the water, it helps to open the mouth of this net. So you've got this giant mouth that is being towed through the water, and the net sort of trails back behind it, two big doors on either end, a float on the top, floats on the top, and lead-weighted line on the bottom. And this can be towed near the surface, it can be towed in midwater, or it can be towed over the bottom, a bottom trawl. And what that thing does, if you can imagine this in your mind's eye, what it does is it catches the whatever the intended species might be. So you can imagine that it's very good at doing that. If you're towing it through a school of fish, it's going to catch all the fish that you want. If you're towing it over the bottom to catch shrimp or prawns, let's say, then the shrimp just sort of bounce into the net and also very effective at catching whatever it is you might be trying to catch. But as you can also envision, it is indiscriminate. It catches everything in its path. And those other animals may not be intended to be caught. They are incidental kill, referred to as bycatch, which is what you referenced. Bycatch are all the things that you don't want to catch in the process. So inevitably, many of those things that you catch do not have commercial value, and they end up being thrown back into the sea as trash. I don't know what the current statistic is, but I think I remember back when I was doing my story over a decade ago, the number was something like 60 billion pounds worldwide. Again, we could easily look that up, but that's a staggering amount of species that are thrown back in.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And again, so again, if we want to make a sort of terrestrial analogy, this would be like trying to catch a few squirrels in a forest. So you tow a net through the forest, you know, that is a giant net, you know, 50 feet wide or 100 feet wide. And, you know, two hunters grab either end of that net and you walk through the forest. And in the process of catching a few squirrels, you're catching all the songbirds and all the raccoons and all the chipmunks and everything else, all the butterflies and everything else that lives there. And then when you get to the end, after towing it for a mile, you dump out everything on the ground and you grab the five or six squirrels that you wanted and all the songbirds and raccoons and other stuff, butterflies and, you know, things that you caught along the way, just get thrown into a dumpster. And that's maybe a crude analogy, but it's sort of what's happening in the ocean. And this has been happening really for centuries. And it goes on out of the view of most people. And there are other indiscriminate methods. There are things called long lines, where a commercial fishing boat will put out maybe 100 miles, you know, kilometers of fishing line with thousands of baited hooks on that line. And they're trying to catch swordfish or some other species, but inevitably other things come over and are attracted to that bait. So you might catch sea turtles or, you know, other things. There are gill nets. You know, they string these giant gill nets that just either drift or are somewhat stationary in the middle of the ocean, somewhere in the midwater, perhaps, or up near the surface. And again, they're trying to catch sharks, let's say. And in the process, they catch manta rays and mobula and all these other things that may or may not have commercial value. So many of the methods that are used in commercial fishing around the world tend to be these rather indiscriminate methods. And it has resulted in the decimation of species and habitat. Again, a bottom trawler that's dragging over the bottom to catch shrimp is not only catching the shrimp and all these other animals in the process, but it's effectively clear-cutting that ocean floor, that benthic region, which has precious habitat for little fish and corals and anemones and all these other things that might live on the bottom, depending where in the world we're talking about. So it scrapes that ocean floor forever. You know, generations will go by before that will be restored. So those are the things that are happening out of our view. And again, it's you know, most folks have no idea, right? And many of the methods are indiscriminate and highly destructive.
And the methods haven't changed. I mean, it's not slowing down. The uproar against these methods that has been happening in the past couple of decades, has that created any change
Not that I'm aware of. There may be some declines in some of those methods. There may be new fishing gear that's being designed. And you know, I don't want to portray fishermen or worldwide fishers as bad guys or the evil people or whatever. You know, I've worked with fishermen my whole life growing up in New England, and I have the greatest respect for them. I think, you know, if I wanted to go to the moon or figure out how to get to Mars and live there for a couple of years, I'd probably hire a team of fishermen because they are some of the most resourceful, innovative, clever people I've ever met in my life. And they're hardworking and you know, they're trying to support their families. And again, it's a complex equation. And to their credit, I think that many of them are looking for better ways of doing things. You know, long lines, for example, have evolved where they're using better kinds of hooks that don't catch as many turtles. And they've created these devices with nets, you know, turtle excluding devices years ago, where turtles that used to be caught as bycatch can now escape. It's not an all or nothing thing. There are many shades of gray, and there are innovations constantly being developed, often by the fishermen themselves, to do a better job of protecting the environment. But, you know, that being said, I think it's safe enough to say that globally things are still pretty rough out there, and a lot of the methods are destructive, and we're probably taking too much. There's very few fisheries that are what we could term sustainable. I don't know if there's any that are truly sustainable. From the researchers I've talked to in recent years, they've told me that, you know, we constantly fish down the populations, and then we often fish down the food chain. When we get to a low enough percentage of a given species, we just move on to something else. So it's just a product of the fact that we as a species, human beings, have become too good at doing this, at fishing. You know, the technology that we use, if you go on to the bridge of a factory trawler, it's like going onto a starship. You know, the electronics that they have, they're getting satellite data from satellites that's showing where the warm waters are and the edges of warm and cold, and that's where the dynamic zones are and more fish are gathering, and they can, with pinpoint accuracy, often, you know, really target those fisheries. They can be very effective at scooping up, you know, all the fish if they really wanted to. So the fish don't have a chance is the bottom line, and there's an appetite for it. You know, consumers demand it. So that's why I think, you know, we really need to create more of these protected areas in the zones in the ocean where fish are given a chance to reproduce and are given a break.
Well, and with these reserves, will you just give us a comparison? How much of land is protected versus how much of the ocean? And is that, I don't know if you know the numbers.
I should know that number, Beth. And it's substantial, though. It is substantial. I mean, it's a much higher percentage on land. It's a matter of how you define protected. So, you know, many scientists would argue that we really need no-take marine reserves. That would be completely off limits. You know, protect a place, no fishing can be allowed in those places. If you use that as your measure, if that's the definition of protected, then it's going to be a much smaller number. I mean, I often say about 3% of the Earth's oceans are protected, but if we look at truly no take, it might be 1 or 2%. So there are what we can define as marine managed areas. There are places that are protected at some level, or they're protected at certain times of the year, maybe during spawning season, which is good. Other times of the year, they do allow fishing within them. And again, I think it doesn't have to be an all or nothing. I think if we have good stewardship and you can sort of give and take, that, you know, that kind of model can be productive in conjunction with more fully no-take marine reserves, with, you know, farming areas, ocean farming. I think if we do all of those things in sort of this patchwork quilt, we can help the oceans to restore. But, you know, we're a long way from being there.
Do you get overwhelmed by just how many things are not going well with the whole planet, but with the oceans especially? Does it get just depressing to say, I need to focus on this, but there's this, and this that are looming right now?
Yeah, it is. And it is depressing. You know, I remember I spent about 2 years traveling around the world working on that global fisheries story, which was published in 2007. So 2005 and 2006, I was traveling around, and I think I became really physically depressed, mentally depressed. I really did. It was a lot of bad news everywhere I was going. You know, I was seeing this sort of devastation. I was seeing little gill nets being placed in mangroves where they were catching fish that were, you know, a couple of inches long or less. I was reading statistics back then and still today of 100 million sharks being killed around the planet, mostly for their fins. you know, the 90% of the big fish in the ocean. I was seeing gill nets that had manta rays and sharks and, you know, billfish, beautiful marlin, you know, dead in nets. It was horrific. And I approached my coverage, you know, more like a conflict photographer. I was sort of in war photographer mode in my mind. You know, I have a lot of colleagues who I have the greatest respect for who go into conflict zones, and I've not done that. But in my mind, that's kind of what I was seeing. I was photographing this carnage, and I wasn't in danger like those photographers are. But the things I was seeing to me were very troubling, very disturbing. So over a decade later, I still think about those things, and I still see it every day. And as you said, now I'm seeing more plastic, I'm seeing all this stuff, and it is very, very depressing. It's troubling. But, you know, I've sort of come to the conclusion that, I've been given this great blessing to be able to do the work that I do and love what I do and can reach a lot of people. I also, have two daughters at home, and I worry about their future, and I feel that, you know, I ultimately have two choices, right? I can give up and sort of accept defeat, or we can fight. We can fight with good science and truth in journalism and put the facts out there. I've long believed, you know, after working on that global fisheries story for 2 years, I mentioned that I did a separate story that was published in that same issue about the value of marine protected areas. And I did that story in New Zealand. New Zealand was then, and I think still is, a rather progressive country in terms of conservation and particularly in protecting their EEZ, their exclusive economic zone, their ocean. And they had a network of marine reserves around the coast that I could see different things. And I could see the resilience. I could see the ocean had restored itself in many of these places. Early on in that story, I worked with a scientist named Dr. Bill Ballantyne, who is often referred to as the father of marine reserves. He was a Brit. He was born in England, and he moved to New Zealand early in his career. And back in the 70s, I think it was 1975, he created the first marine reserve in New Zealand in a place called Goat Island, which is just a little rocky section of the coast. There's a rock right off the shore that they call Goat Island, so it's not really a proper island per se. But somehow back then he was able to create that place, and he had to fight the battle with the government at that time in New Zealand, and with commercial fishermen who certainly didn't want any place protected, and even with the recreational fishermen who used to go there and fish off the rocks. And he even had to contend with his own fellow researchers who used to go to this place to collect species. But somehow he achieved that great success, that victory, and they created this place as a marine reserve, and it did restore. It came back. And, you know, Bill was getting on in years. In fact, he just died last year, very sad. But I remember being in his home one night, and, you know, he just had some candles lit, and he poured me a glass of wine, and he was this bearded, kind of wizened old sage, this wise guy, you know, and wise guy. But he used to roll his own tobacco cigarettes too. And I remember sitting there and telling him about how sort of depressed I was, and having spent the last 2 years. And he rolled one of his little cigarettes, and he was pouring the wine and the candlelight. And he said, "You know, Brian, I believe that if you gather a reasonable group of people in a room anywhere in the world, and you explain to them the facts, and you show them that, you know, the ocean gives us weather and it gives us oxygen, and that, you know, it's where life is created and can exist on planet Earth. And if you tell people that we need to protect about 40% of the Earth's oceans, and today we're only at about 1%, most reasonable people will be shocked, and they will say, well, let's do it, you know, for my future, for my children's future, we just need to do it. I mean, how hard can that be? And the problem is that we haven't really done that. We haven't brought that message to the people. And, you know, that gave me great hope at that time in my life when I needed it. He was a voice of reason and a voice of hope. And the things that I was seeing in those places in New Zealand that had been protected gave me great hope for the future as well. So, you know, I think back to that, and I realize that, you know, in some respects today, it's worse than ever. I mean, you know, in our country, we're seeing this assault on the environment, this assault on science and facts. And it seems like, you know, wow, we're in the dark ages. But I do find people every day, pretty much, or certainly frequently enough, that give me reason for hope. So I think we have to be strong. We have to fight. We have to, you know, use the tools that are disposable, good science, good journalism, podcasts, getting this word out to people on many different platforms, because it matters. You know, it's worth fighting for. And, you know, that's what keeps me going.
Well, and I think there's probably people who think we're beyond repair. And that's what I wanted to ask you. This is something that can be turned around still. Yes.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, based on my personal experience and having worked with scientists and researchers most of my life, I would say that, yes, it's not too late. You know, there are some things that are probably gone. There are places where only pockets of biodiversity may remain in the time ahead. But that doesn't mean we can't still have a healthy future. It may not be what it once was, but, you know, it's like the old saying, when's the best day to quit smoking cigarettes? Today. If you didn't quit today, when's the next best day? Tomorrow. So, you know, it's not too late. We may have lost 50% of the world's coral reefs, but that means there's 50% left. Yeah, we may have taken 90% of the big fish in the ocean, but maybe there's 10% left. You know, we don't have to kill 100 million sharks every year. We don't have to roll back legislation that determines how much carbon we pump into the atmosphere. We can speak out against that and tell our elected leaders that, no, we care about how much carbon. You know, the ocean doesn't have to turn acidic because we're dumping so much carbon into it that its chemistry is changing. These are things that we can change and can control. So I do remain cautiously optimistic. I realize that, you know, the battle lines are drawn and we have to fight hard. But I do think that it's worth fighting for. It's not too late, and we can see a reversal. And, you know, I'll also say that in the places that I have seen that have been protected, you do see that resilience. You know, the ocean does know how to take care of itself. We just need to leave it alone. And during this time, during COVID, where so many people are staying at home, we are seeing these glimmers. You know, it's interesting. Yesterday, I got an email from a friend of mine who lives in Alaska. He lives in Sitka. And he sent me a note and said that he was out, you know, near where he lives, and he saw a huge number of gray whales up in the waters off of Sitka. And he said, we've never seen that in his lifetime. You know, he might see one or two, but he had seen, I think there was like a dozen or 10 or 12 of these gray whales hanging out. And I wrote back and I said, do you think that's because of less human activity, that there's less ship traffic out there? And he wrote back and said, oh, absolutely. It's definitely because of that. And, you know, these are things we've never seen because of that. So I think that sends us a message. I mean, this is a very uncertain time. It's a very stressful time, lots of anxiety that we're feeling for so many reasons. But, you know, within that equation, I think we need to stop and look around and say, what is our relationship with nature? And maybe we can do things better as we emerge on the other side of this.
And I hope we can, and I hope we will, and I hope that this pandemic has been a wake up on many levels. But what can people do on a tangible level, like right now, in terms of change, in ways of not kind of buying into this anymore?
I think information is perhaps the most powerful weapon in our arsenal. And it takes work, unfortunately, to become truly informed. And it's a ever-changing landscape. But one of the things we can do, whether it's now or any time, is to become an informed consumer and an informed citizen. And what I mean by that is that, you know, the choices that we make really do make a difference. We see that certainly in elections and, you know, voting for people that embrace science and embrace conservation is going to determine our future. That is no hyperbole. That absolutely is the fact. And deciding what you're going to eat for dinner or lunch or breakfast also makes a difference. And there are resources out there that you can consult. There are seafood watch cards that you can download on your computer, eliminating single-use plastics, working with companies that are embracing the circular economy. There's lots of buzzwords that we hear out there, but getting to know what those things mean and making choices for you and your family are going to determine our future. So, you know, politicians often or rarely, it seems, have the will to lead. But if the grassroots level, the people can sort of rise up and demand that, you know, whether it's your local grocery store or your local Walmart or whatever, if you say, hey, I don't want all this plastic packaging, I'm going to take my product out and give you back the plastic, you know, maybe that will work in reverse down the supply chain so that they tell people we don't need all that stuff. So I think there are things we can do. An educated consumer, an educated citizen is a very, very powerful weapon in rectifying these problems and ensuring a healthy future.
And what advice do you have for humans in general and this lost connection with nature in terms of getting it back? Because I think that would create huge change if we somehow could reconnect. We've just become so separated, and we're not.
Yeah, we've often seen ourselves, I guess, as apart from nature and above it. And I think that's a mistake. You know, we are very much a part of nature. We are directly connected to it. You know, I think at the end of the day, we long for spirituality. There's something that we need, you know, in our lives that are very much good for our souls. I think almost anywhere you live, you should be able to find a space where you can connect with nature in some way. Slow it down. You know, it's not about a race. It's not a competition. It's one of those things that you can do in life that requires very little effort, really, to just go out and listen to the birds singing here in the springtime, or look at a blade of grass or the trees. Whether it's a rainy day or a sunny day, there's beauty to be found in nature, and it's calming. You know, in a time when anxieties are high right now, especially, we're all stressed about many, many different things. There's a lot to be said for just sort of taking a few moments each day and communing with nature. You know, it's not that long ago in human history that we were living out in nature, in the wild. And I think our brains have sort of evolved quite rapidly, but I often wonder if, you know, they're really evolved to the point where we should be tuned into electronic devices, you know, 24/7. I don't think so. I think, you know, we need to get back out there and smell the roses, literally and figuratively. And that's what's going to calm us down a little bit. And we see things, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I live my life in nature. You know, I've been very, very blessed, as I said, very lucky to have a career that has allowed me to travel around the world and make pictures in nature of wildlife in the ocean and so forth. But even in just the 4 or 5 weeks that I've been home here, I live on the coast of Maine in the U.S. And in just the time that I've been here, I've seen things in my own backyard that I never saw. You know, I saw a hawk the other day flying by with a snake in its talons, and I see so many songbirds. I've seen foxes and squirrels and chipmunks and frogs, you know, chirping at night, and tadpoles in the little bodies of water out in the woods near my house. I've taken my dog out for walks, and I'm just seeing things that I didn't even know were here. So I think we can all do that to some extent, no matter where you live. And it's harder, of course, in you know, concrete jungles in the city and so forth. But I think if you seek, you will find, and it will be good for your mental state, your soul. It'll restore you a little bit. And it's a bit addictive. You know, I've been addicted to nature for a long time. It's a good addiction, and I think it's healthy. And you realize just how much we need it and how connected we are.
So good, Brian. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
To learn more about Brian and to see his work, go to his website, briansceri.com. Our website is speciesunite.com. We are also on Facebook and Instagram at Species Unite. And if you'd like to support the podcast, we would greatly appreciate it. You can do so in one of two ways. Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. And we are also on Patreon. It's patreon.com/speciesunite. Thank you for listening. I would also like to thank everybody at Species Unite, including Gary Knutson, Natalie Martin, Caitlin Pierce, Amy Jones, Paul Healy, and Anna Kollner, who wrote and performed today's music. Thanks again. Have a wonderful day.